You've already mentioned the turbulent times that we're in, when things are difficult, when they are painful, whether it be something we're going through personally or maybe corporately as a church or even as a nation. Do we have the resources? Do we have the godly responses to give to get us through that crisis? That's the question that we asked last week. That's the question we started to open up. And we went to the book of Jeremiah to begin looking at it. To give you a slight recap for those who weren't here. For many people, if you look at the book of Jeremiah, as you see what that man was going through, he faced the most turbulent, chaotic of times. You could say they were the blackest days for the nation of Israel. And poor Jeremiah had to give an unpleasant message in that process. But he faithfully pursued that. One of the things that we saw last week was that the standard offering for most people was to use their own resources, their own wisdom, their own abilities and strengths to try to get themselves through a problem. If I could use the words of the song of Frank Sinatra, "I do things my way," is the song they would have been singing at that time. Instead of going to God, instead of seeking him and asking his direction, they tried to do it themselves. So we looked at chapter 8 of Jeremiah, and we saw that even as in the northernmost sections of the territory, the mighty hordes of Babylon could be heard approaching the lands, the people were rejecting, and yet judgment day was coming. Jeremiah, in that process, as the people were talking, seeing the impending doom, asked a rhetorical question. He asked a question that he already knew the response to, and he said this to them, "Is there no balm in Gilead?" Gilead, this place where this aromatic medicinal product that soothes pain, that's where it comes from, this place called Gilead. He was asking the question, even from yourself, from your own nation, from your own resources, is there nothing that you can offer that can take away this horrendous problem that we're about to face? Is there no physician that can heal it? He was trying to paint a picture because he knew there was nothing that could be done to sort the problem. But that wasn't the end of our study last week. And we realized that God, in his grace, in the book of Jeremiah, doesn't just give warnings of judgment that is coming, he also gives hope. God had put something in place to rescue them. There is a balm of Gilead, and his name is Jesus, and he was the one who is promised. And we reflected on that, and we thought about whether we call on the name of Jesus in a crisis. The one that we are encouraged to keep our eyes fixed on, the one who can soothe, the one who can bring healing to the soul. Doesn't mean he'll necessarily click his fingers and change and take away the problem that we don't want to go through, but he brings healing, the balm of Gilead. Well, that was last week. Today, we're still in Jeremiah. And I want to consider another human trait that tends to come when we're in a crisis. And this trait is that we tend to focus ourselves on the issue, on what we think is going on, and we try to work it all out and solve it in our minds. And in the process, we worry. So we presume to know what should happen in any given situation. We presume what is the best outcome for us, and we ignore the fact that God alone, in his sovereignty, sees the much bigger picture. So I wonder whether we ought to think differently. and I have a different response. When God's basic message to us is, don't worry, trust me. How do we apply that in a crisis? Well, to try and help us start thinking about this, I want to take you back in time. Get you thinking about things that have happened to you in recent times, in our nation, in your lifetime. I want to take us back a few decades. Actually, I want to go back to 1969. 50 years. Put your hand up if you were alive in 1969. That says something about our church, doesn't it? That everybody's got their hand up. Yes, you were all there. In case you were wondering, sugar. This is the soundtrack. Yeah? Any of you have that? Anybody buy that? Yes, okay. Then have you got this one as well? Yeah? That was the soundtrack of the day. So put your mind back in 1969, that's the pop song. Those are the pop songs. Interesting, they were both about sweet things. Good times have never seemed so good, I think was the lyric. But was that really true? Let me ask you some questions. First of all, what do you think was the biggest story of the year in 69? I'll give you a clue. It was an out of this world story. It was Neil Armstrong landing on the moon. And the prospects that all that brought. Maybe trying to give a little bit of hope to people. We can do this. We can conquer the not just our world, but worlds beyond. And they sent men to the moon. And I wonder whether we were all thinking at that time. I remember watching this on television as a youngster. Thinking to myself, I slipped that in quickly. Thinking to myself, my goodness, what does this mean for the future? 50 years on, do you realize there have still only been 12 human beings that have landed, that have walked on the moon? Just 12. One of the things that was said when Neil Armstrong landed on the moon is they put a sign up onto some plaque which said, "We come in peace." In 1969, do you think our world was in peace? Next question. What do you think was the biggest conflict of that year? It was the Vietnam War. Huge. It was in its 14th year. It was horrific. This was the peak year in which more American soldiers were in the country. 500,000 soldiers were in that country at that time. The loss of life was horrendous. Interestingly, I can slightly digress, but for interesting reasons. Last week we were talking about the fact that human beings will do anything to bring their own comfort, yeah? To try to sort their own problems instead of going to the Balm of Gilead. Answer a question for me. How many people in the United States do you think died of drug overdoses last year alone in the United States? Anybody like a guess? 50,000. It's not a bad guess. 70,000 people in the US died of drug overdoses. And the same, actually, is even more the previous year. To put that in its context, only just over 50,000 died in what they consider to be a horrific war for them in the whole of the war. That number now die because of the pressure of life, in desperation, and because of drug addiction. Wow. That wasn't the only conflict. Another conflict. Do you remember Biafra? Do you remember that name? And in this country, I have a vague recollection of it, but I recall them, this country, people marching because of children who were dying in that part of Nigeria. The Biafra region is the southern part of Nigeria, and they were trying to gain independence. That conflict, 50 years on, hasn't brought much peace to that area. The people of that region are still the minority, and they're still struggling with conflict. 50 years on. It was the year of the fight for equality. Yes, some of you remember that. As I looked at that, I'm not sure that was the right year. The photograph was not in 69. But this is when women were particularly shouting for equal pay and marching for it. Interestingly, it was the following year, 1970, that equal pay came because of the Ford Dagenham plant. You'd have thought that that would be the case. But that was the issue of the day that people were anxious about, that they stressed about. Anyone remember anything dramatic that happened in Wales? Apart from Larry's birth, in 69. Sorry? Aberfan, no. Something else? Very good. It was the investiture of Prince Charles in 1969. Now you might think, so what? Why was that an issue? I wonder whether you do remember that there was an awful lot going on behind the scenes. There's an organization called Free Wales Army who were trying to fight for the independence essentially from Britain, from England, and talking about the pressure, and they were not happy with this. 9 people were arrested, and the trial ended on this day. They were arrested and they were prosecuted because they had explosives, they had firearms, and so on. What you might not also remember is on the day there were 4 explosions. Do you remember that? Isn't it interesting? Because this would have been the big story of the day. 2 people were killed the night before when their bomb prematurely exploded, and they died. They wanted to interrupt the day's proceedings. Such was their difficulty in this. This caused people huge stress and anxiety, and yet you can't even remember, I couldn't remember, the events. And just shortly, it all disappeared off our agenda because of riots in Belfast. And the Northern Ireland Troubles began. Isn't it interesting how things move forward? Huge events, huge challenges, impossible situations. Could you have possibly worked out what was going to happen in those things? And the answer is no. And that's just 50 years. We couldn't possibly do that. What about us as a church? That was the church building in around that time. Why did they build that wall? Only to know that they were going to knock it down, put another brick wall on that we were then going to knock down a little bit later with the help of someone reversing into it. Isn't it interesting? I wonder what has happened. I wonder what the church was stressing about in that day trying to resolve. Maybe you could ask some of these people. Don't know whether you realize, but you know some of these people who in the 1960s were in attendance. You recognize Bill. And there are other people. I believe Robin is just there. And this is Suzanne's legs. I didn't know this. It's not interesting, though, how things have changed. You imagine we get wound up about things going on in the church. We don't dress like that anymore. People don't bring Bibles like that anymore. Women don't wear hats anymore. And yet we stress about things of the here and now, don't we? So I'm trying to take you, get your mind to think forward in that. Do you know, when we excessively try to work things out, when we try to second guess what might come, there's a word for that. It's called worry. It's ungodly thinking, and it really isn't good for us. It's unholy thinking. Who thinks they would be wise enough to work out some of those issues and look that far ahead? Can any of us possibly have worked out how the Vietnam conflict would have worked itself out? At that time, there was a great fear of the spread of communism. Today, the great fear is of, in communist countries, consumer goods and their great spread, because we buy most of what we have in our homes from those countries. What a turnaround. Could you have worked out what was going to happen in Wales? And the knowledge that Northern Ireland would become so much more a significant issue than the Welsh issue. In Luke 12, we read, "Which of you, by worrying, can add a single hour to your life? Since you cannot do this very little thing, why do you worry about the rest?" And yet we do that all the time. So let's see if we can just learn some quick lessons from Jeremiah and chapter 32. And let me begin with the crisis itself as it is unplaying. Firstly, recognize that it has now been 900 years since God made his covenant with his people. And in that time, they have rejected him, they have abandoned him, they've denied him, they have been idolatrous. And judgment day is coming. This is serious. No longer is the problem that the distant hordes of Babylon are approaching from the north. Now they're encamping all around. They have besieged Jerusalem itself. This serious threat just got a whole lot more serious. And Jeremiah is right in the middle of it. That's not the end of Jeremiah's problems. He's got other problems. Because he has faithfully told the king all that God has warned them to sort out and to turn around, he's not very popular, and the kings don't like to be told they're about to be conquered and be sent off to a foreign land. So he's imprisoned in the palace. And even worse, so if you think this is a black day, even worse than that, God is saying to them, and don't even try to fight the Babylonians, because you won't win. This is not a case of it might happen, it might all turn out badly. God is saying this is going to happen. You are going to be conquered. And that is the situation that Jeremiah finds himself in. If you were Jeremiah, how would your faith be coping at this point in time with all of that about to happen? Well, sometimes, if that's the crisis, the moment you think things can't get any worse, God challenges us with a test of our faith. And that's what happened in this situation. And God tests Jeremiah. And he does that, firstly, by giving him a completely irrational command. He tells him to do something that just does not make any sense. What does he ask him to do? Buy a plot of land. If that had been you, if that had been me, I think I know what I would have been doing. Lord, are you sure about this? Have you thought about what's happening around us? To buy a plot of land in a time of such horrendous conflict. And that's not the worst of it. The plot of land that he's asked to buy is one right outside the city, in the area which is being besieged by the Babylonians, on land on which the Babylonian army is currently residing. That's the land he's been asked to buy. Can you imagine? How would you feel if I made you a bit of an offer? If I said to you, I happen to have some land. It's beautiful land. You could grow food on it, build a nice house on it. Lovely. It's worth £100,000, and I'm willing to offer it to you for just £50,000. Bargain. Just one thing, it's in Afghanistan, and there's some problems. Is it such a bargain? Would you go for that? Of course you wouldn't. This is a ridiculous thing to do. Nobody in their right mind at that time would have dreamt of going through this. It is a bad investment. But this is what God asks Jeremiah to do. So that's the test. What was his response? The first thing he did was he was obedient. He bought the land. Though he knew the city was going to fall, he knew that people were going to be taken in captivity. He knew the land would be taken away. He bought it because that is what God had asked him to. And just to explain the principle behind that, this chap, Hanamel, was Jeremiah's closest relative. And in that day, if you were a close relative to someone and that person had financial difficulties and had to get rid of some goods, then you, as the closest relative, had the right, had the opportunity to redeem those goods on their behalf, to keep the property, especially in the family name. You'll have come across this before in the book of Ruth. Boaz, remember? Boaz was the closest relative, and he was the kinsman redeemer. He redeemed the situation in that story of Ruth and Naomi. But the interesting thing about this that really struck me this week is he's told he has the right to redeem it, but he's told that it is both an option for him and it is a duty or a responsibility. Isn't that interesting? In the custom of the day, you had the option to redeem it, but you weren't forced to. It was an option. But there was an expectation in the culture that you would redeem it. Sometimes God asks us to go through really difficult situations. And he asks us to show the same response of obedience. He asks us to be obedient even in the midst of a horrendous situation. But God is not a bully. He doesn't force us. He gives us the option. But it is our duty. It is our responsibility. I wonder whether we see the issues that come up for us, the challenges, as being that. We have the right to redeem the promises that God has made to us and reciprocate them back when we are in the midst of a crisis by being obedient, by trusting God, by saying that standing firm, by turning up on a Sunday when time is the issue of the day, when that's the crisis, by giving financially, by giving of our time when those things are the issue. Being obedient to what God has called us to. It is a right. It's an option. And it's a responsibility. I wonder whether we see that when we face these challenges. The second thing we see is that he was accepting that God has a wider plan. Sometimes when God asks us to do things or to endure things, at the time, they seem to perhaps make absolutely no sense to us at all. But the invitation is for us to accept that maybe God knows what's best and to do it anyway, to trust that he has a plan that we perhaps don't understand and just go down that road and do it. Actually, in this case, God revealed part of the plan. He didn't say how this was all going to work out precisely, but he did say in verse 15 that houses and fields and vineyards will be bought again in this land. That was his promise. And God gives us promises that we can stand on. But sometimes he asks us to go through the difficult things and just accept that he knows. He is sovereign. Things are not out of control, and he asks us to go through things, trusting him to be in it. We'd just been talking about all the things that might change over a period of 50 years. In this case, it would be 70 years that they were away in captivity. And even when some of the people started to come back, who knows how long it would be before land was bought and sold once more. But that's what Jeremiah was asked to do. Actually, Jeremiah himself would long be dead at that stage. But this is what God asked him to do. Do you realize that also in Jeremiah, God gives you promises? And he says to you, "For I know the plans I have for you. Plans to prosper you and not to harm you. Plans to give you hope and a future." Do we stand on that when things are tough? Or do we go to God and demand change? Change this. This is not good enough. I want different. Or to complain to him. The big challenge for me as I've reflected on this is, what might God be asking us to do that maybe even doesn't make sense, that he knows precisely is for our good in the long term? I believe God has asked us to do some really difficult things as a church. He asked us to put our activities down, which are things that we love doing and we know we're blessing people. In the eyes of some people, that was ridiculous. Who knows how long we are going to have to wait before that makes sense to people looking on? But what God said is, do it. He asks us to be obedient and to accept he is the only one who is sovereign. Did something else. Jeremiah was also content. He didn't demand to know why. He didn't demand to know how this was going to benefit him. He was content to be this individual, a pawn, if you like, in God's great sovereign plan. He was content. And it reminded me of the Apostle Paul. Do you remember those words from Philippians chapter 4? From verse 12, "I know what it is to be in need, and I know what it is to have plenty. I have learned the secret of being content in any and every situation, whether well-fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. I can do all this through him who gives me strength." When we learn what I truly believe is a secret for God's people, the truly learned contentment, it enables us to face and get through some really challenging situations. But there's one more detail in this story that I have to refer to. This faithful man of God did all of that. He was obedient. He bought the land. But look how he did it. He weighed out the appropriate quantity of silver. He signed the deeds and he witnessed them. And he produced one which was sealed and one copy which was open. Open so that it could be read by anybody. That people would know what he had done. God often doesn't ask us to just do something that proves our faith and our trust in him. He asks us to do something publicly. Believe me, for a minister, you kind of have to stick your neck out sometimes and say, "I believe God is calling us to," and stand up and be counted and ridiculed sometimes by people who struggle to understand what might be going on here. But that wasn't even the end of it. He was then asked to put these sealed items in a clay jar to give them time. To give them time. He was saying, "I want this to last as a testimony." Do you remember the Dead Sea Scrolls? When the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, after hundreds and hundreds of years, they were discovered in a dry desert because they were in a clay jar, and they lasted the test of time. That's what God was asking of Jeremiah. What he'd asked him to do, he wanted to stand. And sometimes when we pass through turbulent events, when impending doom is on the doorstep, God asks us to stand up and be counted, to bear witness to what he's asking us to do for him. Sometimes you go through difficult things. We go through challenging circumstances so that we can testify to others. I wonder if the church could change its perspective on, sorry, I'm going to say the B word, Brexit. And instead of talking about the dooms and the woes and the oh no that everybody talks about, I wonder if God's people could turn that and somehow be positive and say, no matter what happens, I trust that God is sovereign. I wonder whether that would be a testimony to people around us. He testified to what God has done. Those are simple lessons from this passage, but I want to give you an example that really struck me just recently. A friend in Zambia who I met in 2016 while I was there went out with his family to serve the Lord. He has a wife and two very young children, one of them this big. I wonder whether we would risk taking our children out to a country where you can get malaria and where education may be mixed to serve the Lord in that situation. Well, that's what they did, but it's not what he did that impressed me. A couple of weeks ago, I had a newsletter from him, and he reminded me of a situation just like this that happened through someone else who went out there. His name was Brian Aldreeve. This is him. This friend of mine who I met in 2016 works for Foundations for Farming, which is an organization that exists in both Zambia and Zimbabwe. And it was set up by this chap. Brian Aldreeve was an expert tobacco grower in Zimbabwe. He really knew what he was talking about. He was regarded as an expert in his field. And when he became a Christian, he believed that God said to him, stop growing tobacco. I want you to grow food. He'd never grown food before. He wasn't an expert in this. He didn't know what to do. He knew how to grow tobacco. But God said, do it. So he was obedient. And he believed, because God was asking him to do this, it was going to be amazing. He was going to have the best crops and everything was going to be fantastic. Well, years later, Brian was really struggling to grow food. He'd come into financial difficulties. He'd had his farm repossessed. And this man of great expertise was now a laughingstock and ridiculed by people in the farming community. His reputation was trashed. He found himself, quite some years later, on a maize farm in Africa. And maybe he was thinking to himself, Lord, you asked me to do this. It doesn't make sense. What am I doing? And on this maize farm, it's maize which is growing in the background, by the way, again, he started to have difficulties. See, there's a problem in the way people tend to grow food out in Africa. It's a very hot, dry climate. They light fires to burn everything and put the ash in the ground. But then that removes all the surface cover. And then they have deep tillage. They plow the fields and it turns the soil over. One problem being that then when you get the heavy rains, you have sheet erosion. It washes the soil, the nutrients and the seeds off the fields. And he was spending more and more money trying to buy the technology to put deeper plows in and to do the job that was necessary. And he was really at the point of running out of desperately out of funds. So he got on his knees and he prayed to God and said, what are you saying in this? And God revealed to him that in nature, that's not the way things happen. In nature, when one generation of growth has taken place, the leaves fall to the ground. There's a rich mat of vegetation and the seeds grow in that which protects the soil. And after some research, he began to put this into practice and he established this minimal tillage technique where you You see how the ground is covered in the old maize crop? And you just dig a small hole. And in that small hole, you put your seed in, you put your fertilizer in, you put your water in. It takes much less effort. There are no tractors involved, no heavy machinery. It is what's now regarded as conservation farming and has been adopted in much of southern Africa. He thought he'd give it a go. So in his quite large farm, 1,000 hectares, he planted 2 hectares. On that first year, his profits were such that he started to get back into the black. So, feeling this was a confirmation from God, he planted more. And he planted the whole of his farm, 1,000 hectares, no intensive agriculture. Through the profits from that in subsequent years, he bought more and more land until he had 3,500 hectares and was doing far better than anybody else. The picture began to dawn that God had a bigger plan, but there was more than that. The crops grew well, as you can see, even though there's all that old vegetation there, but that was the principle that worked. But there was more that God had in mind. And today, Foundations for Farming is operating in Zimbabwe, South Africa, and Zambia. And this is the friend that I met out there, Dan, and he is now teaching local farmers to survive, to grow crops that they were really struggling without all the expensive technology and without losing the fertilizer that they put in and having to put just a small amount of water in because it's minimum tillage. But notice he's standing there with the Bible in his hand. The other thing that they do every day is they sit together and they teach local farmers how to live their life with God. They have Bible studies every day, in addition to the agriculture. It's an amazing project, and it happened because some guy was obedient to God and did what was insane. He gave up the expertise that he knew and started something else. What about you? What about us? Are we willing to be obedient if God asks us to do things? Are we willing to stand by the faithful life that God has called, even when things are difficult? Are we willing to accept and recognize that God has a much bigger plan? Are we content with however things will work themselves out? And are we willing to testify to what God has done in our lives and what we have done, even when we stick our neck out? That's the challenge I believe he invites us to engage with.